This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow? Welcome back to Harvard God and Gen Z. Part of the occupational hazard of this podcast is that when Harvard kids have finals, they go MIA, they go undercover. So apologize for the delay in bringing out a new episode, but we have to adjust with our clientele. But we are back and we're excited to be back. We're here on winter break, so the students have finally some time to breathe. And we have a very fascinating student with us today. Welcome to the senior, Ben Rabinowitz. How are you, Ben?
I'm doing well. Thanks very much, Rabbi, for having me on.
Ben's a little bit of a different type of guest than we've had so far. So far, we've had people that kind of grew up perhaps with less of an affiliation to any type of spiritual system or religion. Here we have someone who's coming from a different angle, who did grow up involved in Jewish life, observant. So what we're going to do is maybe there's some stereotypes about people that do grow up observant. Perhaps they are blind believers in certain things. Maybe they haven't thought about these big questions about God, meaning maybe they're just something they take at face value. So we're going to test out that hypothesis, see how much, at least in Ben's case, this is something that is on his mind, is something that he has struggled with, especially coming to Harvard. So before we get there, however, I would like to ask Ben, so tell me a little bit about growing up. Was Harvard on the map your whole life? It came on the map later on. Why did you decide to work, I assume, quite intensely in high school to get to Harvard?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think I've always been, and I mean, this is something that was sort of emphasized in my home growing up. And I think a lot of sort of the way I think about things is, you know, both from school, where I went to elementary and also high school, but in large part from the education that my parents and grandparents sort of instilled in me. You know, I've always been a sort of hard worker. I think, you know, whether or not Harvard was on the map, that it was always sort of understood that education was very important to my family. So, you know, Harvard or its peer institutions was always, I guess, something that we thought about. I mean, Harvard specifically, I guess, sort of came on the map a little more in junior year of high school, just sort of thinking about college prospects a little more. It's actually funny. For a large part of my high school experience, I'd say sort of since middle of freshman year, I was most interested in going to Yale, actually. But the reason for that was not an academic one. I received some interest from the basketball program, actually, to play there. That was something that was a big part of my childhood. I played competitive travel basketball. Some interesting stories, happy to share about the religious experience playing AU basketball. I think I realized once that offer was that they didn't really extend a firm offer. I thought about it more from an academic experience, and you know, Yale's great and peer institutions are great, but I think Harvard was where I was most interested.
Okay, I hear that. I mean, you told me that fine education was stressed in your household. I think that's true across many Jewish households, but I think some of the children can actually rebel against that and feel pressured or feel they're not so into education. What for you personally, okay, your parents stressed it, but for you personally, is your personal motivation to strive for such a high
Yeah. Point? Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's sort of my innate nature is competitive. I mean, I mean, is that a learned behavior? Is that innate? I think in large respect, it's probably a product of the environment, but I think in large respect, it's just innate behavior that just sort of who I am and who I've been. You know, it's the way my brother is as well. So, you know, I think, you know, education is sort of emphasized, like you said, across the country, across the world, in a lot of Jewish homes. But so actually, just to clarify what I mean by education, I think, you know, just from an academic experience, from an academic perspective, you know, it's not an external pressure to succeed. but rather it's to, you know, just try your best. And if, you know, you study hard and you don't get the result that you're looking for, then at least you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, you tried your best. That's definitely one component of education that I think was instilled in my home by my parents and grandparents. I think also, and this probably was even more emphasized, you know, the kind of person who you are, the education, the Jewish values, as it were. You know, I think that was also emphasized a lot.
What particular Jewish values are you referring to?
You know, I think being respectful. I think one that my dad really instilled in me quite frequently was, you don't know what someone's going through until you're in their position. So don't judge others. I think it's actually sort of taught in ethics of our fathers also. Don't judge someone until you're in their position.
That's right.
So I think that one was something that he frequently reminded me of, for Beautiful. Example.
Beautiful. So tell me about your Jewish education growing up. So I understand you were a practicing Jew growing up. Was there ever a period of time you considered not being a practicing Jew? Did you ever struggle with that, or was it always something that came naturally to you and something you appreciated?
For sure, yeah. So I've always been, like you said, an observant. I'd say, you know, labels are obvious, but if I had to assign one, maybe I'm not an Orthodox. But, you know, an observant practicing Jew, that was, again, something that the kind of home that my parents established. I would say that it never really seriously crossed my mind to not be observant, to not, you know, practice the things that we do. I'm happy to discuss more detail on that. But, you know, it never really crossed my mind in a significant way, really, at all. I think that at times it became challenging, you know, especially, you know, traveling for basketball tournaments over Shabbat, for example. Mm-hmm. There were like logistical issues that arose. And it even actually, an important decision in life was, I had the opportunity to play high school basketball at a high school that was at a non-Jewish high school. But I ultimately decided that though that probably would have portended better for my basketball career, I decided to go to the high school that I did for, I guess, both social and religious reasons. So I think that it never really crossed my mind to not be observant. And I'm happy to discuss the reasons maybe why that was, to hypothesize on that. But I would say that there have been some challenges that I faced, but I wouldn't say that I struggled with, you know, the decision to remain observant.
With any, what was the most creative solution you had to a situation you faced traveling in basketball, or what did you have to do to make it work?
Yeah, for sure. There's, I mean, a number of different stories. One that comes to mind is, there was the team that I was playing on that practiced downtown in New York. I'm from New York. So they practiced downtown and I live a little further up in Manhattan. So pretty regularly in the early afternoons on Shabbat, I would walk 3 miles to practice, for example.
Wow.
Walk 3 miles to practice and play. And but yeah, I think traveling, you know, there are a lot of logistical things that come up, whether that be from a food, you know, kosher perspective, from a Shabbat perspective, you know, staying in places that we otherwise wouldn't want to stay. Like, for example, my dad and I slept in the gym a couple of times just because there was no hotel in walking distance. So, you know, I mean, those kinds of experiences.
Did you ask for permission, or you just kind of hung on the locker room until they
came
over there?
No, we got permission from the administrators. But yeah, you know, I think those. And, you know,
well,
I think
mattresses, or how did you make it work? Yeah, give me some
chairs.
Details on that.
Chairs.
Chairs.
Put two chairs together. Yeah.
You can sleep on that.
We made it work.
I have to
coats,
say
coats is cover, coats is covers. But you know, I think one thing that I wasn't aware of it entirely at the time, but upon reflecting, was that, you know, it gave me an opportunity to not only explain Jewish practices to non-Jews and people who likely otherwise would not have encountered an Orthodox Jew, but it also gave me an opportunity to think about sort of the practices that I did.
Right.
You know, like think about the beauty, I guess, both the restrictions and the beauty of being Sabbath observant. Same thing for kosher. So I think it was a really, I guess, unique experience, but also one that I am very appreciative of.
That's incredible. And it is interesting that you see in the world that the two holidays that are most practiced by Jews worldwide, Passover and Yom Kippur, are the two most difficult in certain ways. You know, not eating bread for a week is not simple. Finding the right matzah is expensive. And Yom Kippur, obviously, many Jews fast. The vast majority, it's the one thing they do. So there is kind of an interesting concept that when you put that effort in a way, it does make you stronger, keeps it stronger in a certain way. No question those things did. So how did you explain to a non-Jewish person what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a 10 or 11 year old, I guess I wasn't the most knowledgeable. But I, you know, just that these are practices of my religion, of the my belief system. And they were, I don't know how well I explained it, but I think they were generally very respectful. I did not experience any anti-Semitism from any of my teammates, for example. I think they're pretty understanding.
I'm sure they respected it. I'm sure seeing someone really hold tight to what they believe is actually can create a tremendous respect.
Yeah. You know, I think also if you produce on the court, then there are no questions to ask.
Very nice. So there's kind of a phenomena that people talk about of what's called social orthodoxy, where people are orthopractice, but not necessarily orthodox, orthodoctrine, but orthopractice. Social orthodoxy is the fact that there's no question that the Orthodox world has a lot of benefits community-wise. It's a tight-knit community. It opens doors networking-wise. There's a lot of reasons not to want to leave such a thing. But that doesn't mean that people actually believe in, as you mentioned, the practices and the beliefs. Did you ever grapple growing up with the actual belief system, namely, as the focus of this podcast being the concept of God, there being a God, not being a God? What were the reasons for you to maintain that belief? After all, that is the first of the principles of faith is that there is this one God and you shall know the gods before that one God. Is that something that came up for you, ever struggled with in your life?
Right, for sure. I mean, sort of as you alluded to, I think there is this trend in orthodoxy, of social orthodoxy, but also, I mean, even in people who are practicing, you know, who are strict adherents to the commandments and the mitzvot, for example, even in those communities, it's a very legalistic and intellectual sort of pursuit and practice. You know, it's you know, do you know and do you observe the laws of Shabbat, for example? And that in, you know, again, to theological, but you know, that can sort of be done almost independent of sort of conscious thinking about belief in God. You know, same thing with kosher and in large. Yeah.
No, you said something interesting there. You used the word intellectual applies to the observance, but not to God. What is it about God that you find non-intellectual, or why can't there be an intellectual approach to the concept of God?
Right. I mean, I think that there is one. I didn't mean to say otherwise. Okay. I would say that there is, and I think Maimonides actually discussed this in depth in his commentary on the Mishnah, which I haven't really studied, to be totally forthcoming. I haven't really studied that so much in depth. And when I have, I haven't really understood his arguments. Yeah, I tried grappling with it a few years ago, but I didn't really understand his rational, intellectual arguments of the belief in God, just because sort of intuitive to me, and this may be something that is, it's maybe an immature thought, immature in the sense that it hasn't really been thought through and sort of, you know, pruned and probed in significant respect. But I would say, you know, faith is not, and this is fine for me, it may not be fine for other people. This is just sort of just how I approach it. And I don't want to, you know, disclaimer, I'm not speaking for all Orthodox people. You know, just for myself, what works for me is that faith is not a science. You know, I take a lot of math courses at school, and what's important there, and this is just, again, just something that I think about, you know, what's important there is concrete, you know, theorems. This is just a fact that we can prove, you know, with, you know, equations and assigned quantitative values and, you know, things of that nature. It's very concrete and clear. And that's science, that's math. But faith, I think, you know, it's a sort of leap of faith. It is not really a science in that same respect. You know, I know Maimonides gives that elaborate proof, which I have not really understood. But that to me is not the fact that I don't have that, that I haven't thought about in sort of mathematical sense of a proof in the belief of God. That doesn't mean, you know, at all that I don't believe in God or that I'm not comfortable with that belief.
So again, on what basis is that belief? When you say a leap, why make that leap, or what are you leaping over exactly?
Right. You know, I'd say the belief is, you know, whether that be from a just an observation perspective, sort of, I guess, as a lot of the commentators on the Abraham episode about his monotheism, about that he observed God through nature, for example. You know, you just observe any sort of majestic from a natural perspective or otherwise, you know, just like it's so clear, it's so evident from that God exists. You know, even on the more mundane level, just we were talking about ethics of our fathers before, you know, and I think this Mishnah actually is one, it's a very poignant one. In the first Mishnah in the third chapter, and I think this is something that I think is applicable even outside of Judaism, just like this sort of humbling thought that and the rabbi in the Mishnah, Akavya ben Mahalalel is the rabbi. He writes that, you know, one of the things that he discusses is that man comes from dust and returns to dust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that every individual, every human being is exactly that. It's sort of, and it's a very humbling and if you really want to think about it, it's a very scary and intimidating idea.
100%.
That we're, you know, specks of dust.
And you're giving the generous reading of it. The putrid drops and
putrid drops, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But
regardless, yes. It's very humbling.
You know, it's a very humbling experience. And when you think about that, I mean, any human creation is ephemeral. Yes. Every human being, just from the fact that every human being is ephemeral. So when you think about that, I mean, how else can the world exist? I mean, this is obviously a very simplistic understanding. How else can the world exist? How else do all these that have lasted, you know, thousands of generations? I mean, just that from that sort of perspective is again, that's not a scientific proof, but that's sort of the faith that I have, and I'm okay. Very.
I guess my question to you then, as a scientific thinker, why would we use the word leap? You know, for example, when is it not a logical thought? Is it not an illogical thought to say that something comes from nothing, that from there has to be kind of the most basic scientific fact is this concept of we're looking for causes and effects of things or relationships, equations. So therefore, doesn't there have to be on some level a something that causes or puts into being a something? And doesn't that something have to be a something else of a different kind? Why is that? What makes that a leap of faith versus a somewhat intellectual, maybe not conclusive, maybe not subject to the scientific method, that I agree with you, but at least it's not a leap of faith, but a very logical deduction, we'll call it, of some sort.
Right. I mean, perhaps the word leap was the wrong choice of words, but I think you're right. That sort of exercise is definitely logical, is an intellectual one. I mean, I think one that I've done, it's, you know, it's sort of the Maimonidean, Neo-Aristotelian, prime mover sort of approach,
correct,
which I think makes a lot of sense, which I think that's, again, it's the sort of framework that I have as well. It's not, and this is maybe sort of what I meant, it's not a conclusive theorem that is rigorously proved, but I would say that initial logical step is one with which I agree, and it's one that is, you know, intellectual in nature.
Okay, so that's
why. Again, I just would like to clarify. Again, this is not a sort of, we discussed this a little bit earlier. This is not a question that I think about often. The belief in God. I think that it's a fundamental tenet in Judaism. I guess in Orthodox Judaism, absolutely. But it's not one where I spend a lot of my time, which I guess maybe is problematic, maybe is not. But
so that's a good point. So when you say you don't spend a lot of time on it, you know, there's a maybe perhaps this concept that the function of a mitzvah is in a way to create that connection. One way is you can call it's a command, but many commentaries also say the word mitzvah means to connect back to a source. Is that something that you do ascribe to, or it's not not something that you relate to in that way?
No, I think that that definitely is. I think that the functions of the mitzvot are in large part to create or to further foster that bond relationship between the individual, or I guess even the community, I guess it depends on the mitzvah, but the individual, the community, and God. So I think that I do think about my relationship with God very frequently.
Okay.
But I think that the intellectual exercise, similar to the one that we just engaged, or even, you know, more rigorously, is not one that I spend a lot of my time doing. Just, I don't know, you know, why that would be. I guess a product of, you know, sort of the environment of, you know, many yeshivas don't really, I mean, I don't want to speak for many yeshivas, but my experience in Jewish day school and even in yeshiva in Israel for college was not one where we thought about that question a lot.
It was a given, perhaps, and perhaps they didn't feel that it was worth re-exploring for most of the
students. That makes sense.
So if you were to engage someone who would have trouble believing you are, you know, you're coming from a place like Harvard, would that be the argument that you would use to say, hey, there is a logic to this. It's not, there's an intellectual basis for belief in God, or you prefer that, hey, if it's not 100% scientific, it's not really worth having the conversation because it's not provable.
Right. I mean, that's a very interesting question that I haven't really had much experience with before. I mean, no, I think trying to convince someone of anything is already a challenging thing, especially if they're not sort of, primed or predisposed to be thinking in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically a question of this magnitude is a tricky thing. So how would I go about sort of aiming to engage someone who's not predisposed to having that sort of mindset? I mean, I think...
And you're not convincing them, at least really explaining yourself.
Explaining myself, I'm very comfortable with the notion that faith, this may not convince anybody, but the way that I would explain myself to someone who doesn't believe in God, I mean, I'm very comfortable with the notion that faith is not science. That may make other people more uncomfortable, especially, and I don't want to be disingenuous because, again, I know that Maimonides has a very scientific approach to this, which, as I mentioned, I don't have a full understanding of. But for myself, where I am right now, I am comfortable with that notion that faith is not science, and that this is a product of my, you know, that I was instilled with this belief, and that I even on my own, I have observed the belief in that I have observed the existence of God in many different ways.
Can you share some of those ways that you feel you've had an experience of it?
Sure. I mean, I think regularly, you know, one of the observances that I keep is regular prayer. And I think that the prayer experience, it may be predicated already. So this may not actually answer your question because it may already be predicated on believing that you're praying to God, or I guess, an eternal being, or, you know, whatever. So it may already be predicated on that. So that may not have been, but having said that, I would say that, sure, it's already predicated on that belief, but I think that that experience is one which further, I guess, entrenches or enhances my belief.
Can you share about that? Because I think it's interesting. A lot of people have trouble with prayer. They don't really know who they're praying to or what they're getting out of it. And maybe they feel silly doing it. How do you get around all that and make it into a meaningful experience for yourself?
Right. Yeah. How to make prayer meaningful is challenging, especially for someone who doesn't have already that belief entrenched.
But I think even for people that do have that belief, they still have a hard time. So what makes it for you meaningful, and how do you get so much out of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of it is focus. A lot of it is focus. I think.
And when you say focus, focusing on what particular, the words, or words take you somewhere?
Well, sure. I think firstly, the first element of focus is to not be distracted by other things. And I think especially in the world we live, external distractions are very frequent. Like, for example, one of the things that I'm learning right now is the letter of Nachmanides, the Yerat HaRamban. And in it, one of the things that he talks about is when you're praying, to remove external thoughts, whether that be from your head or from your heart, but to remove external thoughts. So I think that, first of all, that point is a is a very important one that I think a lot of people take for granted, to have the right focus and intentions in prayer to remove the external thoughts. Whether that, you know, anything academic, extracurricular,
and items from your pocket, I think most importantly nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. It actually maybe tricky in COVID because a lot of people are praying on their phone. but yeah, so I think, so that's firstly. So just to have, I think to make prayer a meaningful experience, and what do I mean by meaningful? I guess to, in some respect, its relationship with God, I think the first thing that's important is to remove those external distractions. Then what, so once you're open to, I mean, again, I don't teach classes on prayer, so I'm definitely not qualified to be giving this advice, but you know, I think once you're open to focusing on prayer and the relationship itself, there was one teaching that a rabbi of mine in high school that actually taught me from Rabbi, so this, I think it's Rabbi Yosef Albo, actually. All right, so it may be Rabbi Albo, maybe
I think it someone is. Sefer Yikarim, yeah, I believe that's where it is.
Yeah. Sefer Yikarim. That when, so when you start, I don't want to get too technical here.
Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, that the first line in the Shemona Esrei, in the regular prayer that we say, is there are actually three phrases within it. So it's Hashem, so that just addressing God. Sfasai tiftach. So what that literally means, and so this is just a little like helpful tip that my rabbi gave to me, that I think this is the idea of maybe Rabbi Albo. Sfasai tiftach means literally, you open up my lips. You open up my lips. But the way to read that is that without your help, I would not be able to open up my lips. So not only the observation that God is the one who is enabling me to do this, but that without God, I would not have been able to do it. Okay. And then Ufi Yagi Tehila Secha, the last phrase, is that the way to read that is sort of with an interrobang at the end. Like sort of Ufi Yagi Tehila Secha, and it'll be my mouth, a very humbling thing. It'll be my mouth who can offer your praise. So that sort of mindset, those, so the way to read that sentence is it's three separate phrases. And that sort of humbling mindset.
Beautiful. So humbling, and also just the realization that we're sentient beings that can talk as itself. Where does that come from?
Exactly. Now, of course, that again is probably already predicated. You're coming to that experience with the belief in God. So
yes and no, but I think just having that quiet moment where you're like, wow, the fact that I'm a conscious sentient being, how does that happen? Where does that come from? The fact that I can even speak and say words, and I mean, the brain research on the speech areas of the brain are mind-boggling. Ultimately, man is called the speaker. That's what really separates us from the animals, and it is a remarkable step in development that really does separate us. I do think it, even if you're not sure if there's a God, I think just even thinking about that point can lead someone on some level to awareness.
Absolutely.
And when you got to Harvard, were your beliefs challenged at any point, being in that academic environment, any science classes knock you in certain ways, or you were so strong or you didn't find anything compelling out there that would shake you up in any way?
Right. This is just my own experience, and this could be a product of the courses that I took. You know, I took a lot of mathematical courses, applied math and economics. Actually, also, I'm doing a secondary in music, so some music classes, but not really any philosophy or, I guess, science of the world, or I don't know, you know, where it would come up. But so it could just be a product of the courses that I took. This sort of question never really arose in the courses that I took. And even in the interactions with people at school, this was not a question that was regularly discussed. So I wouldn't say that in my Harvard experience, my beliefs have ever been tested or tried. I wouldn't say, you know, that at all. Yeah.
Do you feel kind of lucky to have, quote unquote, a relationship with God in your life? What do you think it does for you? A certain strength or ability to weather difficult situations? What do you think it does do for you on a day-to-day basis to have that in your...
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think I'm definitely very grateful and feel very blessed for the education and value system that was instilled in me by my parents, by my teachers, but I think I think a lot of education is really by the parents and the grandparents in the home, by the family. So I'm very, very grateful for that. And, you know, in terms of what belief in God specifically will have, or having a relationship with God, which I think is probably predicated on the belief in God, right? For any rational person, right? You're not gonna have a relationship with someone or a being you don't believe in or believe exists. But I think that relationship is very helpful in keeping a healthy perspective on life, in that sort of, as we discussed, anything that I do is so meaningless in the scheme of the world. Any accumulation of material wealth is so unimportant in the scheme of things. Anything that's done that is not to the end of, not to the end, or does not achieve to the end, you know, achieve the end of spiritual growth, religious growth, is really not important. And I think my relationship is very helpful to keep that in perspective, have that attitude that, you know, what really matters is, you know, relationship with God, this is a humbling sort of perspective that, you know, what human beings do, any human being in the scheme of things is a speck of dust.
And that attitude gives you a sense of grounding and maybe releases some sort of anxiety about life, and that you kind of have your eyes on a bigger picture.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a double-edged sword. I mean, yeah, it alleviates the stress of certain decisions, sort of ground, very grounding idea. At the same time, it does put a lot of pressure at it.
What kind of
every decision that you make, every, you know, that belief or that relationship with God is a humbling experience. It alleviates the stress or the anxiety of decision making, whether that be from a career or academic perspective or otherwise. But at the same time, if you really want to think about that idea and engage with it on a significant level, it really puts a lot of pressure on every decision that you make, meaning that, you know, you're forced to consider things and think about, you know, to make the right, quote unquote, right decisions all the time.
Do you mean ethically? Is that what you're referring to, that to make sure that everything you do matters now on a more cosmic scale, and therefore
yeah, exactly.
Everything you do exactly. Has to have a certain ethical dimension that's in line with that?
Exactly. I mean, you know, you think about it, you have, I guess, the decision that you're making now no longer matters from a, I don't know how to, you know, adequately or accurately describe this level, but from the level which you previously thought about, you know, in this world, career, wealth accumulation, that type of thing. And now it matters on a much more significant level. And even decisions that you hadn't previously thought were important now are important. So it actually adds a lot of stress in that respect.
Interesting. Do you think that's the greatest barrier for people being able to kind of accept the concept of a God? Is it that pressure? Now, I don't call it pressure, but significance of everything you do is too much to bear on some level. It's much easier to just kind of let go of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's the biggest barrier, you know, barrier to entry, but I think that could
a big
be
one,
very,
let's say, not the biggest. Yeah.
Yeah. That could be a very big one. Because if you want to be very, you know, rational about it, and you want to think about it very objectively, then that sort of mindset is going to have significant, massive consequences which don't exist in your other, in, you know, in your previous framework.
Sure.
So that could be a big impediment.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing about your journey and about all the amazing experiences you've had. And it's amazing to see how strong of a person you must be to hang, you know, really to have such a strong connection that you have, given the environments you've been in and where there wasn't always the greatest support for it. So that's really, really incredible. And you should continue to maintain that strength and be a light unto others to show people that, you know, what a benefit it has been for you personally and what a benefit it can be for everybody. So thank you very much for your wise input.
Oh, thanks so much, Rabbi, for having me.